Mr. Wilson, good morning again.
Good morning again, Your Honors. Mike Wilson. I represent the appellant in this matter, Tracy Parnell. We've raised two assignments of error in this appeal. May it please the court, counsel for the state. I'd probably start by addressing assignment of error number one in our brief. Essentially, we're arguing that the district court judge wrongly applied a procedural bar to various claims of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel made by my client in his pro se post-conviction motion. I will note for the record, it was a pro se post-conviction motion filed in the district court. I entered my appearance once this case was ready to progress to this court. So in the motion in question, the district court judge here, what he did was he found that there was not, that all the claims were essentially barred based on, they could have been raised on direct appeal, that sort of thing. And what I wanted to point out, or what I'm bringing to the court's attention here in this appeal, is that he raised these issues, and some of which were not addressed directly by this court in the direct appeal. He raised them in the context of an ineffective assistance of appellate counsel argument as well. Now, the state has filed its brief in this matter, and the state's position is that the pleading, the post-conviction motion, did not sufficiently submit an ineffective assistance of appellate counsel argument. What I've done, particularly in my reply brief, is tried to show the court, demonstrate for the court, that in fact Mr. Parnell in his pro se motion did make specific arguments, not only as to the conclusion of law that he received ineffective assistance of appellate counsel, but that there were specific failings on the part of the trial counsel and then in appellate counsel in failing to raise these arguments on direct appeal. And ultimately, it seems to come down to a matter of the organization of Mr. Parnell's pro se post-conviction motion. And that's sort of how I read a lot of the state's argument. In other words, because he sort of conflated his claim at the beginning of his, I think it's paragraph 6 of his motion, where he says he received ineffective assistance of both direct and appellate counsel, he later then broke down these claims in subsections where he listed facts. And particularly there are some emails that he wants the court to do is offer him an evidentiary hearing where at which he can explore further whether the failure to turn over these emails, the failure of his defense to be able to use them in his defense, was prejudicial and warrants a new trial. So at this point, that's where we're at. And ultimately, there's a second assignment of error. I can touch on that if Your Honors want me to.
Well, tell us about the emails. What's the allegation, ineffective assistance of appellate counsel, in regard to the emails?
Well, it's essentially a failure to preserve more than anything. I believe the emails were, the emails were presented, they were present in exhibits. I have this in my brief, but exhibits 9 and 12. And ultimately, those, what he's saying is that those emails, they go beyond the degrading effects of, you know, simply the fact that the state chose to switch experts and sort of demonstrate the reasons for that. There's what we contend is a lacking foundation for that second expert testimony regarding cell phone tower data.
A lack of foundation?
In other words, the accuracy of
Mr. Schutte?
Yes. And in other words, the accuracy of his testimony was degraded, and this court recognized this in the direct appeal. What it said was that the precision accorded to that cell phone testimony could have been degraded by the first expert's opinions. There needed to be a drive test, that sort of thing, to confirm the accuracy of that testimony.
O'Kelly, you're referring to O'Kelly?
O'Kelly was the first expert.
Did trial counsel have an opportunity to cross-examine Shute or Shute?
There was cross-examination. I think from our perspective, it was insufficient. It could have gone further. And in fact, what the exhibits showed, what the emails showed, is a willful decision to pursue an outcome determinative approach with the experts. In other words, to brush aside O'Kelly in favor of going with someone who required, who was going to give them the testimony it wanted without the precision that O'Kelly was recommending.
Is all of that in our motion, in the post-conviction motion? Everything you've just told us about, can we look to the post-conviction motion and find it in there somewhere? And if so, where?
So that's the crux of the state's argument, I believe, is what you're getting at, Your Honor. And what I'm trying to do here in the appeal is point out that we're not trying to make new factual allegations on appeal. That's not what I'm trying to do here. I'm trying to raise inferences. Yes, I'm advocating an interpretation. I'm advocating an interpretation of the pro se motion. I have to do that. I came into this case on appeal, so I'm doing my best to advocate a specific interpretation of what's there. And what I see there, when you look at the context of his motion, he did specifically state the state, this is a quote from the motion, the state knew that there existed exculpatorial material evidence. That's in there. And so that's the argument on, let's see. I'm
paragraph
sorry. 6C. 6C. Thank you, Your Honor. You found it quicker than I did. And that is in there. And so I'm arguing from that we can glean, based on the record and based on, you know, the arguments in the motion, we can glean that Mr. Parnell is raising a failure to preserve this for purposes of bringing it to this court, or to bring it to the district court and eventually this court if need be. I'm going to reserve these last 2 minutes for rebuttal, but that's where I'm going with this. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Faust, good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Stacey Faust. I'm Assistant Attorney General representing the appellee, the state of Nebraska. First, I'll go into the layered ineffective claims, because that's the crux of counsel's argument and where we left off. Parnell's motion does not sufficiently allege them. It doesn't come down to organization. It comes down to the fact that there's an absence of allegations. And while I understand Mr. Wilson's position, the motion is the motion, and he's not allowed to glean anything from it. There has to be specific allegations in the post-conviction motion. And what Parnell's motion, like many pro se post-conviction motions that this court and the state sees, includes these introductory paragraphs where they list several areas of law and then make more specific allegations below those paragraphs. But those introductory paragraphs will take off all sorts of categories of law, like in this case, due process, equal protection, ineffective assistance of counsel, due process.
In terms of ineffective counsel, I'm having trouble forming the question, but is this layered? Did the counsels withdraw?
It needs to be layered, yes, Your Honor, in order to be properly before this court.
Did the trial attorneys withdraw?
They did not, but as this court addressed in the previous opinion, he had new appellate counsel. Appellate counsel did raise an ineffective assistance of trial counsel claim, and so it's the state's position that obviously appellate counsel wasn't confused that all ineffective assistance of trial counsel claims needed to be raised on direct appeal it necessarily follows Parnell wasn't confused
in the direct, either. In the direct appeal case?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. So what Parnell needed to do was he needed to specifically allege how the facts of his claims constituted a violation of his constitutional rights. And to do that, he needed to actually connect the facts of his claims to the specific law for them. And when you look at his motion, you will not find any ineffective assistance of appellate counsel specific allegations as to deficient performance or as to prejudice. What you will find is an ineffective assistance of trial counsel claim for the emails and a prosecutorial misconduct claim for Schutz's testimony. And both of those are procedurally barred. Second, Parnell's argument that he wasn't sure if he could raise ineffective assistance of trial counsel claims on direct appeal. I just addressed that with Justice Miller-Lerman's question. I don't think that that's true. Appellate counsel knew, therefore I think Parnell knew. In the end, he needed to raise these ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claims, and the state maintains he didn't do that. He didn't make sufficient allegations of them, and we ask you to affirm the district court, unless this court has any questions for me. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. 2 minutes and 14 seconds.
2 minutes and 14 seconds, Mr. Wilson.
Thank you, Your Honor. Justice Miller-Lerman, you sort of hit on something there that it's procedurally was kind of a nightmare on the direct appeal, it looked like. And what happened was there were multiple attorneys that either didn't withdraw and then or withdrew at one point and then re-entered their appearances as appellate counsel. And so it was definitely unclear at some point whether
We cleared that all up in the direct appeal, didn't we?
Yes, but the Supreme Court, Your Honors, you ruled after the opening brief was submitted. So you did at one point require, try to clean that up by saying you need to withdraw or you need to stay on. What are you? Are you appellate counsel or are you not? And that's fine. But again, all that was after the opening brief was filed.
But weren't there allegations of ineffective assistance of trial counsel on the direct appeal?
There were some.
So isn't that issue, they had the opportunity, they took the opportunity. So where's the confusion?
He did. And that's the thing. Your Honors, it's difficult to say for me, obviously, coming into this case on a post-conviction appeal, to say exactly who was thinking what. But to the extent that there's ambiguity in the record as to what my client knew at the time the opening brief was filed, I think that ambiguity should be read in his favor. That's why I left this second assignment of error in our brief here. Because if there's ambiguity, you know, you can't really fault him. And I know, you know, that's what the state just suggested, is that if appellate counsel knew, then Mr. Parnell knew.
Well, you would assume that appellate counsel was in discussions with Mr. Parnell, and together they were putting together their assignments of error and alleging any ineffective assistance of trial counsel. I think that's the inference, is that
trial counsel
didn't do it on their own. They did it in conjunction with Mr. Parnell.
Yeah.
Which, and I think is reasonable.
You almost have to make that. So I get that. I understand that, Your Honors. And ultimately, you know, I see my time is ending. I'll just point out that with a pro se brief, a pro se motion and a post-conviction motion, to read it in the way the state's suggesting, which is you have to put every single specific assignment of error and then tie it directly to the law and do it in such a way that even I have a hard time doing sometimes, I'll be honest, to hold a pro se litigant to that standard, especially an inmate who doesn't necessarily have the resources that an attorney has, I think is a little draconian. So I think it makes sense, and I hope the court will agree with me, that it makes sense to read the motion in its entirety and, yes, glean not from outside the motion, but glean from within the motion what the litigant's trying to say. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Wilson, were you appointed in this matter?
I was not appointed in this one, but thank you for asking.
Well, thank you for your service anyway.
All right.
The next case of the day then is State versus Joseph J. Butter case,